Hi there, I'm Athena, the author of Pollinators.info, and you're listening to podcast episode 4. This is an interview with Dr. Nathan Holland, who studies Sanita cactus and Sanita moth pollinator interactions. Well, first of all, thank you so much for your time today and for joining me to do a podcast.
No worries.
I'm excited that I could find someone to talk about moths. A lot of people don't realize that moths are important pollinators, too. Okay, so how would you describe your job, or what is your position, so people will know what it is that you do?
Okay, so I am a research professor at a university, and my job entails teaching as well as research future generations will learn from.
And where do you teach?
I am right now with the University of Houston.
Okay. How would you briefly kind of sum up your research with the Sanita moth and the cactus?
Got interested in this system as a model system in which to investigate theory about positive interactions between species that have positive effects on both of the species. And so this is a fairly specialized system and a one-to-one relationship between the moth species and the cactus species. And that made it fairly trackable for me to develop theory and then test it in nature to understand major question. One, what determines the population dynamics of both the interacting species, and why doesn't this positive feedback lead to mutualistic species such as moths and cacti just growing indefinitely?
Now, can you explain what you mean by a one-to-one relationship with the moth and the cactus?
By one-to-one relationship, I mean that the cactus has a pollinator, and that pollinator is the one and only pollinator. In turn, the moth has one plant that it pollinates, and it interacts with that one and only one plant.
Oh, okay. So this would be an obligate mutualism between the two?
Right. So it's very much so an obligate interaction, which we're learning that such systems are less common than we previously thought. Right. In nature, most plants are pollinated by many different species. And many pollinators interact with many different plants, and it's less common to have just one pollinator that interacts with one plant that depends on just one pollinator. And that leads to some ecological issues that could be problematic if one or the other disappeared.
Right. So what specifically are you looking at with this system?
One of the issues I'm trying to address and understand, which we've studied in ecology for many, many decades with other types of species interactions, is how does the density of the moth as a mutualist influence the reproduction and consequently the density of the cactus? So how is it that abundance influences, shapes, and molds the interactions between the moth and the cactus? As you can imagine that, we generally think, well, more is better,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
You know, more cake for me after dinner is better for me. And so oftentimes we think about that in terms of mutualism, but it may actually be a case where more is not better.
Okay. So in this case, what exactly would that mean? More moths are not necessarily better for the plant?
Right. So as it turns out, the Sanita moth is kind of like yucca moths. It's doing the plant a really great service by pollinating the plant. But the moth also, while pollinating, moth lays its eggs in the flowers.
Mm-hmm.
So young depend upon the developing fruit of the cactus that their mothers pollinate. This makes it a bit of a tug and pull relationship for the cactus, because the cactus feeds the adult pollinators, but it also pays a small price in giving away some of its developing fruit.
Right.
So more moths is good because you get more pollination, but you also get a whole lot more eggs. So maybe it's better in terms of the abundance of the moth to have an intermediate number of moths so that not too many eggs are laid, but a lot of flowers are still pollinated.
Right. So it's a tricky balance. And is that something you're looking at? What is the optimum number of moth eggs?
Exactly. So we're looking cactus, does the cactus have any sort of strategy it can employ to keep moths from becoming overly abundant, and what is the consequences of that strategy for the moth abundance? And it turns out that the cactus likely does have a strategy to regulate the moth population at levels that are best for cactus reproduction.
Okay. Interesting. So just so that people have an idea of what kind of animals and plants we're talking about, can you briefly describe what this moth looks like?
It's a fairly drab moth that would largely go unnoticed if you weren't really paying attention to the cactus.
Mm-hmm.
The moth is maybe 10 millimeters, has pale in color, and has one little gray stripe, very teeny little gray stripe going down each of its visible wings.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a nameless moth in the Sonoran Desert.
What's the scientific name?
The scientific name is Upyga virescens.
Okay. It's got no common name?
Well, its common name is that of the cactus. We call it the Sonita moth.
Oh, okay. Like a yucca moth. And a lot of people have never been to the desert Southwest. It's one of my favorite places because I think cacti are so neat. So could you tell us a little bit about the Sonita cactus and what's its range and what does it look like and when does it bloom and that kind of stuff?
Right, so the Sonita cactus is a columnar cactus, and so it's in a group of cacti that have many, many stems that are like columns, hence the name columnar cactus.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of four species that are occurring in my study site in Sonora of Mexico. Columnar cacti in general are, if we watch some old John Wayne movies from way back, I'll remember seeing those images with one arm up, one arm down. And Sonita is a little different from that cactus, which is the saguaro cactus. The Sonita cactus will have many stems that radiate from the base of the plant.
Mm-hmm.
These stems can range in number from a young plant that might have 15 or 20 to an older plant that might have 100 or more, and these stems can get up to 4 and 5 meters in height.
So they
get very tall.
So that's like 15 feet, wow. Yeah, so what's the range of the Sonita?
So the Sonita cactus, unlike many of the cacti in the Sonoran Desert, the Sonita cactus is actually endemic to the Sonoran Desert. Its most northern limit is just north of the U.S.-Mexico border in Oregon Pipe Cactus National Monument.
Okay.
There's a in that park called Sonita Basin, and it's named after the cactus. And its southern distribution goes all the way down to the bottom of the state of Sonora, along the Sea of Cortez, the Gulf of California, and just barely into the state of Mexico, just below the state of Sonora.
Okay, neat. So what do the flowers look like, and when do they bloom, and where are they on the cactus?
The flowers typically are located at the tops of the stems, rather than the bottoms of the stems, so you might have the top 2 or 3 feet of a stem that's flowering. It'll produce dozens to almost 50 flowers sometimes per stem.
Oh, wow.
The flowers usually are produced anywhere from early April through late July, where the cacti can produce about 3,000 to 5,000 individual flowers. The flowers are fairly small, maybe an inch and a half across. The flowers are pale white to sometimes very pink color.
So what exactly happens when a female moth pollinates, and then where does she lay the egg? What does she do in the flower?
Well, it's unique because most moths and most pollinators in general visit flowers for the incentive of the food resource that flowers provide to the pollinators. So that's usually nectar and in some cases pollen. Well, the incentive for the Sonita moth to visit the flower is more as a place to lay her eggs than it is for nectar resources, and so flowers don't tend to contain a lot of nectar.
Okay.
So the first thing the moth will do is pollinate the flower, and it engages in what we refer to as a specialized active pollination behavior, whereby the moth deliberately rubs pollen from her abdomen onto the female productive part of the stigma.
Mm-hmm.
So the females will then lay an egg, usually on the petals of the flower, before she departs that flower to go on to another flower of another plant. The flower itself opens at night and closes usually by the morning, and within hatched, and the larva is crawling into the fruit of the cactus where it's been able to eat some of the developing seeds that are the response of the mother's pollination.
Okay, now with yucca moths, I know that the yucca flower doesn't ever really open much, so nothing else really goes into a yucca flower. Does the sanita flower function the same way, or does it ever open up so that something else visits it?
No, it's quite different. In fact, sanita flowers do open all the way up. They're exposed to many different insects and animals. We see insects that eat flowers or the plants sometimes, and we see insects that are in the flowers looking for nectar, but they don't find it because there's not much nectar there.
Mm-hmm. So do the flowers have lots of pollen, like most cactus flowers?
They're much reduced in size and shape compared to some of the big bat-pollinated flowers. Those bat-pollinated flowers just have copious amounts of nectar and pollen. These flowers are smaller and have much less pollen, much less nectar.
Right. So even though other things visit it, the sanita moth is the only one that pollinates, or it's the only one that pollinates effectively, or how does that work?
It's largely the only pollinator. There are a few co-pollinators, some small, beautiful bees called halicted bees, that in the morning hours, just around sunrise, can visit the flowers and do a little bit of pollinating.
Okay.
These bees are, our experiments show that these bees are largely unimportant for two reasons. One, the bees visit the flowers after the moths, so the moths have already done the job. And two, often because it's hot in the Sonoran Desert, often the flowers close before sunrise. Bees are unable to then access the flowers.
Right. What are some particular challenges involved with this research?
Well, there are always professional and personal challenges. One of my personal challenges is not eating too many fish tacos in this beautiful fishing village that I work in. That is a true encumbrance, but realistically, some of the challenges posing scientists as a whole now are the same challenges that are posed to me as an individual investigator, and that's having enough financial funding to get out and do the research to help provide the intellectual material for the textbooks for our children.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's financially can be expensive, and it's important for our government to continue to support it. In a more practical stance, a lot of the work occurs at night and at late hours. And as I get older, being up at 2 in the morning and working with pollinators isn't as easy on my body as it was when I was 25. So sometimes the nocturnal work can be challenging. And then being in the desert, for me, isn't a hardship or a challenge, though some people find the desert environment a challenge.
Yeah.
I actually find the Houston humidity a little bit more of a challenge than I do the dry desert heat.
Okay. So what do you like most about it besides the fish tacos?
Well, for me, it's really into nature and being able to look at some really important fundamental questions that will help us to understand how nature operates and should be able to collect data, learn about a system in nature that might apply to other systems and to mutualism and pollinators in general. So it's a lot of the intellectual work, and then just being in the desert at night is, while it can be tiring, it is also just an incredibly beautiful place to be anywhere in the world at night. Absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of lights. There's lots of stars and the silhouettes of the cacti against the moon. And when you take a moment to enjoy those scenes in between, you're looking at the flowers and the moths and collecting the data. It's quite tranquil.
Yeah. So I try to, in all the podcasts, relate the research to the general public somehow so that people will understand, well, why should I care? Why should the government spend money on this moth in Mexico? What does that have to do with me? What kind of things would you tell someone that you met eating fish tacos that this relates to them in their life?
Right, so that's a really good question. It's a very important question, and I think the answer is probably best conveyed via analogy. We talked earlier about how this is a one-to-one relationship and an obligate relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And in this particular case, if you went out at night and didn't know the moth existed, you probably wouldn't recognize that it was there and around, want to reach out and say, wow. And we often don't see them and notice them because they are occurring at night, and they typically are less beautiful than the diurnal butterflies.
Right.
But this particular moth, as an example, can be analogous to small pieces in an old mechanical watch. So you can imagine yourself opening up the back of a watch to change its battery. And you can see some important pieces that you know if you remove one of those important pieces, then the watch is going to stop working and we just aren't going to be able to know what time it is. But there are also other little pieces down in that watch that you can't really see. And those are analogous to this particular moth, and many moths in general that are important pollinators, whereby if you remove the moth or that little small piece in the watch that you don't see, then the system, the watch, or the ecological system as a whole can start to break apart, and some of the things that society depends upon as a whole can diminish.
Nice.
So many of these cacti, for example, and the Sunita cactus is one such example, produce fruit that are very good and enjoyable, and some indigenous as well as local cultures use and consume and make jelly out of. So if we lost the pollinators, the moth pollinators, then we would no longer have some of these wonderful jams and preserves that are bought in Mexico or in Arizona that people will send as holiday gifts to their relatives.
Yeah. So like the saguaro, the cinnita was probably an important food resource and maybe even a textile resource for the dead spines to native cultures before European settlers got that way.
Exactly.
Cool. Okay. What would you recommend for people who want to help pollinators in general or moth pollinators specifically? Do you have any recommendations for things people could do?
Yeah, there's always the nonprofit organizations that, you know, accept donations and that also fund research. You know, like in the Sonoran Desert, there's Arizona Sonoran Desert Museum. I guess for pollinators in general, for someone that might be interested, I would actually recommend a book that came out, and I want to say just a few years ago, but now that I think about it, it's probably been over a decade now, but it's a book by Dr. Steve Buckman and Dr. Gary Nabahan called The Forgotten Pollinators.
Yeah, it's actually been more than a decade. It's hard to believe, isn't it?
So I don't know whether we're aging ourselves. Pollinators as a whole, that's written to scientists and to the non-scientists alike, and it's just a wonderful read, so I highly recommend that, and that has some resources within it to direct people to how they might help with pollinators.
Something that I like to always encourage people to do is plant a native garden with native plants. If you're lucky enough to live in the Southwest, you know, if you look for all kinds of fun cacti and other succulents and just native wildflowers, you're going to be providing food to maybe not the cinnita moth if you don't live in its range, but pollinators that'll visit those plants at night and pollinators that'll visit those plants during the day. So something I try to get people to do is think about natives when you're planting.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that what you're suggesting, Athena, is really appropriate for wherever you live.
Yeah.
You know, whether it be in very cold parts of Alaska or whether it be in the humid summer months of Athens, Georgia or Houston, Texas, we can engage in something that Dr. Mike Rosenzweig at the University of Arizona refers to as reconciliation ecology, and that is sort of doing backyard ecology to utilize our own yards to put in native plants that then help in urban areas to local natural resources such as moth pollinators to be able to continue to persist. So
yeah.
That's really an important point you made.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks very much, Athena. Good luck with your projects and your work. I'm really pleased to know that somebody's out there doing what you're doing.
Once again, you've been listening to Pollinators.info podcast episode 4. I'm Athena, the author of Pollinators.info, and this was an interview with Dr. Nat Holland, who studies cinnita moths and their obligate mutualism with the cinnita cactus in Mexico. Stop by pollinators.info to learn all kinds of neat stuff about pollinators and the plants that they visit and how you can help pollinators, and join the pollinator conservation movement by signing up for the free weekly pollinators.info email newsletter. And did I mention you'll get free stuff? There's free stuff. There's free stuff now, and there'll be more free stuff in the future. So once again, thanks for listening, and stay tuned for next month's podcast. Take care.